This is Karen Brewster, and today is May 8th, 2019, and I'm here with Frank Norris in the Federal Building in Santa Fe, New Mexico, for the Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park Oral History Project. Thank you, Frank, for making the time today.
Glad to be here.
And as I said, you were interviewed before about your time in Skagway in 1988 by Sandy Faulkner at the time, now McDermott. Mm-hmm. So that covers some of your background and how you got to Skagway, but I'll just do a little summary of your background and where you're from originally.
Okay. I was born and raised in the Los Angeles area. Got a master's degree in 76 from the University of Arizona. And while in the early 80s, I was working for a consulting company as a historian in San Diego. The work started to peter out, and I started looking for other opportunities. I had worked for the Park Service as a volunteer in parks in 81 at Custer Battlefield National Monument. Found that I very much enjoyed working for the Park Service, so I applied as a seasonal for the summer of 83, and fortunately was granted a position, and I ended up spending six summers working for the National Park Service in Skagway as a seasonal or other, you know, non-permanent situations.
Mm-hmm. And what is your master's degree in?
In geography.
Not history.
It is. I later got a PhD again in geography, but both my thesis and my dissertation were on topics of historical geography.
And where's your PhD from?
University of Washington in Seattle.
So why did you pick Skagway for that seasonal job in 83?
Back in those days, you were given an option of applying for any two parks in the system. There was a recognition on that kind of master application form that certain parks were easier to get into than others. They were pretty consistent about, don't bother trying for Yosemite and Yellowstone because you're not going to get in. And indeed, most of the historical parks, along with cave parks and certain reservoir parks and that kind of thing, had asterisks beside them in which they said, you know, these get fewer applications. And being of somebody who loved history anyway, this fit very neatly into what I wanted to do. I had done some historical work on homesteading in the California and Arizona deserts, and so my other application was to Homestead National Monument in Beatrice, Nebraska. And as fate would have it, and of course Klondike was the other application I sent it into, as fate would have it, the chief ranger from Klondike called me on a Tuesday and offered me a job, and on Wednesday the superintendent of Homestead called and asked for a job, but life takes its twists and turns.
And who was that ranger from Skagway who called you?
The chief ranger at the time was Jay Cable. He started in 78 and continued working there for, I'd say, 15, 18 years, and then later transferred over to the Anchorage office. So he and I had a chance to work together for many years.
Mm-hmm. And the job in 83 was to do history, or was interpretation?
No. Every year the park would hire about five seasonal interpreters for staffing the visitor desk, for doing walking tours, for giving programs either in the afternoon or evening. Just, you know, the usual variety of seasonal ranger interpretive kinds of tasks. When the chief historian Bob Spooty found out about some of my expertise, you know, as a in terms of historical research, we got to talking, and he arranged for a number of projects that kept me busy oftentimes during the spring or fall months. So it worked out well for him. There was somebody on the ground, particularly so because Bob really enjoyed Klondike Gold Rush and Skagway. He had spent 2 years there in the late 70s, and in terms of the park units in Alaska, Klondike and Seattle, Klondike and Sitka, were the only two that had a historical emphasis to it at that time. Mm-hmm. So he really liked having the idea of somebody on the ground there that could essentially do the work that, given the inclination, he would have liked to have done himself.
Yeah. So in 83, 84, when you started doing those history projects, Bob was already the chief historian in Anchorage?
Bob was the chief historian the day I got off the boat in 83. And, you know, I served my usual summer, and then during the fall, I think we probably got in touch. And, and I think I worked for him for just a month in the spring of 84, but then in 85, 86, and 87, it was either working on Chilkoot Trail projects, on National Register nominations, on, you know, various things. There was even a little White Pass work that was done. But to me, one of the real thrills of working in Skagway was it was a new park. I can't find anything more exciting to work on than a gold rush. I mean, things are so, you know, out of the ordinary. And Bob had essentially staffed really a pretty good library. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot to work on. And there were just an awful lot of untapped scholarly topics that I couldn't wait to dive into. And for instance, at the Alaska Historical Society meetings in 1984, I gave a report on the role of the military in Skagway's history during the kind of extended gold rush period. And, you know, particularly having come from both Southern California and from the Custer experience, it was a breath of fresh air to see that so many interesting, important topics just had not been done. So that was something that I was able to sink my teeth into, a lot of topics that were just waiting to be completed.
Yeah, well, we'll get into some of those specific projects. But your role of the military, I went to the Seattle unit this trip when I hadn't been into their exhibits before. They talked about the Buffalo Soldiers. I had no idea that there was military up there at the kind of the Gold Rush. I know about the World War II part now from doing research, but I didn't know that.
Company L, 24th Infantry. Yep. Captain Hovey was a white guy, but everybody that served under him was African American.
And they were there as law enforcement on the Gold Rush trails?
Yes. They were in a position, though, that by the time they arrived, it was either, I think it was late 99, early 1900, and it was a pretty sleepy area by that time.
That was kind of my memory of the exhibits, is by the time they got there, it was kind of too late.
Yeah. I mean, it was the transition period. The Gold Rush was calming down. The railroad, White Pass Railroad, was just completed, and Skagway was quickly being converted from a Gold Rush town into a railroad town.
Right.
And in which, during the railroad period, or the Gold Rush period, there had been up to arguably 12 to 15,000 people in town. Once the railroad was completed, it was a town of 800 to 1,000 people.
Yeah. So the Buffalo Soldiers didn't stay for very long?
They stayed for probably 2 years before the Army was represented in Skagway off and on from the spring of 98 all the way up until 1904. And so the Buffalo Soldiers were, after several units had been there and before a couple of others were. So there was kind of a turmoil in the exact representation of military units.
So what was the reason for sending the military up there in the first place?
To provide American might if need be, because at the time of the Gold Rush, the border between the United States and Canada had not been... It it was kind of a long story, but there was a very vaguely defined border between the U.S. And Canada. Canada, of course, being represented primarily by the English at that time. Canada was just starting to emerge with its own independent foreign policy. But the Alaska boundary settlement did not really get finalized until sometime in 1903.
Okay.
And it was a result of Theodore Roosevelt kind of putting the hammer down on this sort of bilateral commission that had been created. What the Canadian Mounties did was, in a kind of an extra legal way, in February of 1898, in the midst of the winter and in the midst of the gold rush craziness, they established a command post at the top of both White Pass and Chilkoot Pass, and essentially said everything behind us is British territory.
Mm-hmm.
And in kind of a serendipitous way, that kind of ad hoc decision turned into what became a permanent boundary.
And the Mounties there were enforcing customs, what we would consider customs and crossing the border regulations, right?
Essentially, they were guaranteeing public safety because there were a bunch of Americans that had absolutely no knowledge of what life was like on the Canadian side, and they enforced they called it a ton of goods.
Right.
But essentially, they were there to make sure that people had 1,100 pounds of food and 400 pounds of other equipment, and if you couldn't convince the Mounties, you were reasonably well prepared to spend the rest of the winter and on into the summer, with what you had with you. They turned you around.
Right. They didn't want you dying or lost in the middle of Canada someplace.
That's right.
But did the U.S. soldiers, were they positioned? Did they have stations up at the border?
No.
I guess people weren't coming the other direction.
No, they weren't. They were stationed both in kind of ad hoc residences or tents in Skagway itself. There was also a dock that had been built over on the Dyea side.
Mm-hmm.
It was called the Dyea Klondike Transportation Company Dock, and they were camped over there. There was a parade ground in town in Skagway. And it's a little unknown in terms of exactly what they did.
Yeah.
There are not that many diaries or documents that talk about them physically patrolling the trails. They were there, on kind of a macro scale. If there were any threats from the British government, anything having to do with typical crime and punishment matters, they did not play any role.
That's what I was wondering, with crime and violence in Dyea and Skagway or on the trails. Was the military the law enforcement, or who did law enforcement?
There wasn't much law enforcement.
Yeah.
And in fact, there's a well-known case up in Sheep Camp of a kangaroo court in which a man was executed because he'd stolen somebody else's provisions.
Mm-hmm.
And that was meant to not only deal with him specifically, but to spread the word up and down the trail that, we don't want this kind of thing.
Sends a good message.
Yeah. I mean, the typical person for them to get up and over the trail would make 30 or 35 trips, hauling things on their back up to a certain point. And there was nobody at those cache sites until somebody came up, brought in, the last of the provisions, and then they'd move it on to the next point.
Yeah.
So there was a huge amount of trust involved, and sometimes that trust was violated.
I think there would be a good economic opportunity to say, hey, pay me, I'll guard your stuff.
That's right. Well, and then the local Native Americans, they made a killing because for people that didn't want to have to carry all the things themselves, there was an Indian village, quote-unquote,
right,
in Dyea, and it Chief Isaac, who essentially saw to it how much the Indians got paid, and they got paid very well.
I would hope so.
Yeah.
That was a lot of work. Well, we kind of got off the off. Us historians, we're going to wander into all these interesting subtopics. So that first summer in 83, you were doing interpretation.
Yeah, I was a standard in-town ranger. And in fact, for 3 years, that's, you know, during the midsummer months, mm-hmm. May to September, that was my job, a GS4 interpretive ranger.
And I know you talked about this a little bit in the previous interview, but that was a long time ago. So the programs that you gave and the tours you gave, were you given a canned program or you developed it yourself?
No. Bob, during his years of Bob Spoody,
right.
when he had lived and worked in Skagway, had his primary product was what was called the 10 building survey or 10 buildings study, in which he had made thorough analysis not only of the history but of the kind of architectural development of each of 10 buildings that the Park Service owned and had plans to you know do some reconstruction or you know renovation on. And so based on those histories, he had probably a long paragraph about each of those buildings, but he also wrote thumbnail sketches of all the non-NPS buildings up and down Broadway between 2nd and 7th. And so we use that as the grist to put together a walking tour, which would usually take, I don't know, an hour and 15 minutes, something like that. And a couple of times a day, we would take people from the visitor center up and down Broadway and you know point out other things along the way. We also were responsible for and we could develop any kind of interpretive program, but you know, just something that we gave in the Park Service Auditorium to, you know, on a topic related to the Gold Rush. So.
And you could pick your own topic and write
sure.
your own presentation.
Well, and previous interpreters over the years had taken slides and put them into a pretty comprehensive slide file, so there was this enormous bank of images where we would talk and then move the slides forward as part of our presentation.
It's back in the day when you used a slide carousel, not PowerPoint.
PowerPoints were not part of the landscape
right.
at that time. Yeah.
And did you have films that you showed? Because now I know that's a big part of the programs.
There were. One of the primary films was called Days of Adventure, Dreams of Gold, put together by William Bronson, I believe it was. That had come out in an hour-long format, but the interpreters, knowing that people wanted a shorter version, working with the Harpers Ferry Center, they cut it down to 20, 25 minutes, something like that. Another major interpretive product was a presentation by Steve Heitz, who is he now runs a major building in town conducts tours very much like Martin Itchen used to. I think he actually has one of Martin's old cars, but at that time he was just kind of a man about town and working seasonally here and there, but he had a gift for songwriting and he loved to sing, and so he had put together he had written a song about the Gold Rush, which I still have a copy of on a 33, although I'm not sure if I could play the thing, in which he sang that song and then we went ahead and added a series of slides to accompany his words from the song.
Mm-hmm.
So it worked out very well. It was about a 10 or 12 minute presentation. And I think every hour on the hour, we would run either Steve Heitz's presentation. Usually once in the afternoon, we would find some longer movie. Pierre Burton had done an excellent black and white film called City of Gold about Dawson City, which had won some awards. He had put it together from probably from the 50s at a certain time. Of course, Pierre had grown up in Dawson City and was a you know, as far as the Klondike Gold Rush was concerned, he was considered the ultimate authority. Mm-hmm. Historians since that time have kind of recognized that there were certain shortcomings or biases in his work. And of course, that's going to happen with anybody's work. But to this day, I still have a very high opinion of the work that he did. He came out with his book, Klondike. In the U.S., it's called Klondike Fever, in 57, 58. And then just about the time I started working there, he came out with a photographic accompaniment to that book called Klondike Quest. And so, you know, those books, I think, are still in print and are being sold, particularly in places like Skagway and Whitehorse.
Well, do you have some examples on the changes in the views on the history of what he came up with that have been questioned now as maybe not accurate?
Oh, I would say Pierre came out of a journalistic background, and he was very strong on tapping into the excitement of the gold rush, and he was a very good writer. But he's also a proud patriotic Canadian. He's been dead for several years now. But I think a sober, objective historian out there, if such people existed, would say he probably leaned toward including Canadian sources more than American sources, and showing the more positive or virtuous side of Canadian viewpoints, and perhaps highlighting some of the more wretched sides of the American experience. It was pretty nuanced, though. I mean, it stands up today still as very good history. I had once written to him saying, because Klondike Fever is not footnoted, and in a explanation he said, the footnotes are out there. If anybody is interested in this, call and let me know. So when I wrote him, he said, I think over the past 20 years, 3 people have written and asked about footnotes. So I decided not to go ahead with it.
Oh, so you weren't able to get them from him?
No.
But there, as you see, that's the difference from the journalistic side versus a historian. A historian would have footnoted every single sentence.
I wish he had.
Yeah.
But he did what he did, and I suppose if a historian went through there, he could kind of going in the back door find out pretty well where he got his information.
Yeah.
But I don't know if anybody's actually taken that step.
Right. But so you don't have any specifics in it that were questionable that you remember?
Oh no. I mean, he never committed blatant falsehoods and errors. It was more of a nuance thing.
Yeah. Well, as you say, it's sort of, I can think in other pieces of history and the way things get told that some things get maybe quote unquote romanticized. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean it's wrong, it's maybe not quite.
Actually, an author just in the last couple of years has really approached this topic head on in an issue of Alaska History Journal. So, and this is a historian who's, put articles in Alaska history many times before. So I'm glad to see that being done. And it just sort of recognizes Burton's work for what it is. I don't think it particularly diminishes it, but, history is an ongoing process of people writing and then other people critiquing existing work and building on it. Yeah. So it's all to the good.
Right. That's the standard practice in academia, whether it's history or some other subject. You keep building and you look at what somebody else found and, I found a new perspective on it. Or certainly the way we do history has changed with, you say, is there such a thing as unbiased?
Yeah. Before Burton's book came out, Catherine Winslow had come out with a book called Big Pan Out in the early 50s. And other than that, there really weren't volumes that tackled the entire Gold Rush experience head on with any kind of, you know, widely approved quality to them.
Mm-hmm. So when you showed up in 83 to be an interpreter, did you have to very quickly become an expert on the Klondike Gold Rush?
I think the typical experience with anybody showing up as a seasonal interpreter pretty much anywhere is the chief ranger or the chief interpreter gives you a series of materials, tells you that you have a week to prepare some kind of presentation and or prepare information for a walking tour or whatever you're going to do, and then you just kind of build up from that. An awful lot of people, of course, in the those experiences just stick around for a summer or two. I was in a position where I kind of really fell for it big.
Yeah. That was our question, is why did you decide to stay in Skagway?
I was in a position, both professionally and personally, where I wanted to live in a small town. I saw some potential to do a bunch of research. I was not in a position, you know, in terms of wife and children, of which I had neither one. I was in a position to just kind of live in a fairly minimal way and explore a small town in Alaska. I consider those some of the best years of my life. I lived in Skagway not continuously, but most of the time from the spring of 83 until the fall of 88. So very rewarding times.
And we know nowadays people who go to Skagway have a hard time finding housing. What did you do about housing, and was that problematic?
It was not problematic at all, because the White Pass and Yukon Railroad had run continuously from 1900 until October of 82. And so in 83, a number of railroad workers had left town, and the town was hurting economically, and there were a number of vacant places. In fact, I was able to, the people I worked with in this instance were wonderful people, but they had a single wide trailer that they wanted to make sure they kept the heat up on, and they essentially said, we'd really love to have you be there. We'll charge you rent during the summer when you're working, but other than that, we just want to make sure the place stays in one piece. So mm-hmm. I stayed there for several years. It was a very satisfactory, arrangement.
And the park was still in its early days then?
Yes, the park was established by Congress in June of 1976. And the first staff came on in 77, and so it gradually evolved from there. The superintendent was there in 77. By the time I arrived in 83, there was a superintendent, a chief ranger, a chief interpreter, a chief of maintenance, several maintenance crew people. An awful lot of the employee activity was revolved around a fairly large maintenance crew that was going through a number of the various buildings as part of kind of a master plan of taking the Gold Rush era buildings that we had purchased in the late 70s and renovating or restoring them according to those plans.
And do you remember the names? Like, who was the superintendent?
It was Richard Sims when I showed up.
Okay.
Dick Hoffman had been the first superintendent, but he had, I think he started in 77 and stuck around until, I'm going to guess, 81. The administrative history would be more specific about that.
And then the chief of interpretation was?
Betsy Duncan Clark.
Okay.
And the chief ranger was Jay Cable. Chief of maintenance was John Warder.
Okay.
But there was a historical architect from the Anchorage office who was permanently duty stationed in Skagway. His name was Dave Snow, and he was in charge of all of the various, reconstruction and restoration operations.
Right. And so when you got there, the railroad depot that has been restored and is now the headquarters, that was not yet completed.
It was still being worked on.
So where were the park offices?
The park offices were in the Arctic Brotherhood Hall.
Oh.
So the first, if you walked into the Arctic Brotherhood Hall, there was a stairway that headed upstairs. I think there were two rooms in there. One of them was for the superintendent, and one, I think there was an administrative assistant who was in one corner, and there may have been desks for a couple of other people there, but it was a pretty economical operation there.
Yeah.
And I believe it was in March of 84 where the depot/administration building of the White Pass was completed, and so 83 was the only year in which we gave, we lived and worked out of the AB Hall.
And then the programs and the visitor center interchanges, was that in the downstairs of the AB Hall?
It was
Hall?
In the auditorium of the AB Hall.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know they had an auditorium in there.
Yeah, you kind of swing around the right side, because you'd walk in, there was kind of a small ante room.
Mm-hmm.
There was a visitor center desk in which we kept brochures and that kind of thing. Then you swing around the right side, kind of down a narrow hallway, and it feeds into an auditorium.
Sounds pretty tight quarters.
And upstairs there was a place where we had rigged up some film equipment, where we actually had projectors, that you put the spools on and run that.
Mm-hmm.
So oftentimes when that took place, there would be somebody on stage and somebody else up top making sure that the projector cooperated.
What was the visitorship like?
Visitorship then, as well as now, was largely determined by the number of cruise ships in port on any given day. Cruise ship industry has transformed Southeast Alaska, and for that matter, a number of other coastal areas in Alaska. In 83, our staffing numbers were largely determined by the number of cruise ships in port on any given day. And I think the largest number of ships in 83 would have probably been three at any given time.
Three in one day?
Yeah,
okay.
Because the White Pass dock could fit two ships, and then the Anvil dock over on the other side could fit a ship. But I think Tuesdays had the maximum number of ships. But a large ship in 1983 held 600 passengers. I understand that there are some cruise ships that go up there these days that have 4,000 passengers in them. But I remember that there was a ship called the Daphne, and there were a number of other Princess boats, and then Holland America, wander in. Actually, I'd better take back the Holland America. I'm not sure that they had a presence during the earliest years that I was there.
But they started to come in the later 80s when you were still there, do you think?
Well, there had been cruise ships coming into Skagway ever since, I would say, early to mid 70s, something like that. There was a fellow named Chuck West who was instrumental in kind of getting the cruise ship industry off the ground.
Yeah, Tours.
Yeah, exactly. But by the time 83 had come around, West himself was running something called Arctic Exploration Tours. It was actually one of the smaller companies operating in town. Princess was the largest corporation, arranging for ships. And then you had the main hotel in town, which later became a Westmark Hotel, was simply called the Klondike Hotel. And I would be hard put to tell you who ran that hotel in those early days.
I always assumed, since it's called a Westmark, that Westmark built it. I didn't know it had a previous life.
Yeah. In fact, this may give some description about the early cruise ship industry.
In the admin history, yeah.
Yeah. And, these things have slipped.
Right. And actually, if you think about it, tourists were coming up there since 1900 in a different way.
Well, a chapter of the administrative history shows that that shortly after the Park Service established a presence there, the city organized a district commission. Right. You know, they outlined, you know, an area kind of roughly Broadway 2nd to 7th with a few lips, extensions on either side, and part of that was a requirement that any new building that took place in the historic district had to architecturally conform to, you know, some notions of what Gold Rush buildings look like. And this Dave Snow that I mentioned essentially helped craft the requirements there. And then the Historic District Commission would weigh various proposals of new building in town and see to what extent it conformed. So the there is a dining room that fronts up against Broadway, which is an extension of what we called the Klondike Hotel. And that dining room front had to be approved by the Historic District Commission as fitting into vaguely Gold Rush looking architectural guidelines.
Right, and they enforce the color of paint and the font of the signs and
encouraging board and batten or shiplap or whatever were approved methods, because we had a wonderful bank of historical photos at the Park Service to show what buildings look like at that time, and it helped create a list of do's and don'ts.
Right. So the visitorship, it was mostly cruise passengers, and it was smaller than what it is now.
I would say that, and you'd need to talk to like a CVB head to know more, but in those days, because the cruise ships were not enormous, I'd say that somewhere around 2/3 to 3/4 of the visitors to Skagway between May and September were off the cruise ships, and the rest was rubber tire traffic off the highways.
But in those years, as you say, the railroad was no longer running.
That's right.
So do you think that brought more visitors into park activities?
What takes place whenever cruise ships are active in a town, they strive for vertical integration. Vertical integration being the idea that if somebody comes off of one of their cruise ships, they want to see to it that they are busy doing cruise ship approved activities, be it walking tours, driving tours, gold panning demonstrations, you know, the salmon fish fry, whatever they're doing. They want to be able to be responsible. They don't want they don't want their cruise ship passengers taking idle walks around town. They don't, you know, given a choice, and I'm being, you know, over the top here when I say this, they would rather have them shop in a cruise ship approved gift shop, perhaps with an inducement, you know, for 10% off that they receive while on board the cruise ship. So that those techniques got more and more sophisticated over time, and there were a number of independent gift shops, restaurants, snack bars, that kind of thing, that got a considerable amount of activity. That kind of thing, you know, the competition got more intense over the years, just during the few years I was there.
Mm-hmm.
So, and of course the cruise ships got bigger and more companies got involved. One excellent antidote to these relatively large cruise ships is there were a number of what we called explorer boats. And these were boats that held maybe 75 to 110 people. And people that really wanted to immerse themselves in what they could learn about Alaska rode on these, like the Majestic Alaska Explorer. They would come up, they had their own itineraries, they would go over to Glacier Bay and see different parts of the bay than other people did. They would go into various coves and fjords that, of course, the cruise ships either couldn't go into or didn't want to. And people would come off of the Explorer boats and ask questions that were just very sophisticated and keen, whereas, and I say this as kind of a dramatic way of the other end of the scale, some people would come off of the larger cruise ships, say, I heard there was a gold rush taking place here, tell me something about it. So there were widely varying levels of knowledge and interest in the gold rush experience. Some people just wanted to go into town, you know, pad up and down, look at the gift shops, and go back to the boat. Other people, you know, had a great deal of interest in the gold rush. So one of the challenges of being an interpreter was to recognize how people wanted to know about the gold rush, to what degree did they want, and to recognize that not everybody was going to be intensely interested in the historical nuances of the gold rush, that you needed to meet them and deliver a message that would appeal to all varying levels of visitors to the visitor center.
And now, were there any exhibits in that visitor center at the AB Hall?
There were a number of very large photographs that I think had been prepared by the Harpers Ferry folks. These were probably, you know, 8 feet square or something like that. And there was a major photograph of the Golden Stairs. There was a shot showing chaos on the Dyea waterfront with, you know, a lot of goods packed up, you know, in a pretty chaotic fashion. And a couple of others along that line, too, in which there was not a great deal of interpretive variety, and a lot of that waited until the completion of the visitor center, which was, you know, just a year
right
after that.
Now, I talked to somebody who had been an interpretive ranger for a summer in the late 70s, mm-hmm. and he mentioned his large photos. His memory was that they were in the old railroad depot, but not restored. Have you ever heard that?
My recognition, when I showed in 83, is that, of course, the AB Hall was all we had.
Right.
And so I think there were some of those photos either in that anteroom area as you walked in or in the auditorium area.
Yeah.
Those are the only areas they could have been.
Right. But you haven't heard that in the 70s they actually used the old railroad depot in its less than ideal condition?
Actually, now that you mention it, in 77, which was the first year in which any interpretation
right.
was done, as you enter the area where the current visitor center desk is in the railroad depot, that was the railroad, or I'm trying to think that by 77, I think the Park Service owned it, or maybe it was the National Park Foundation owned it, because they were kind of a holding company
okay.
that actually purchased the depot building and held it for a number of years. But visitors could go into that area, but beyond that, there was like heavy drapery that prevented people from going beyond, because the rest was either dangerous for construction reasons, or there were probably upturned nails, or it just wasn't ready for prime
right,
time.
Right. So that space was used in 77.
Just that
right.
corner area
right, just
around, you know, where that corner window,
right.
there are doors on either side.
Right.
You know, the visitor today, once they go past the visitor center desk, they can wind around there's a display room with some materials, and then you continue on after turning left and you go into the auditorium.
Right.
None of that existed.
No, I know that, but that confirms that in 77 when he said they were in that
in that small corner area.
Corner that yeah. matches, because he talked about large photos, and now I'm like, oh, well, maybe he was getting it confused with the AB hall, but it sounds like not. So that
yeah.
confirms that.
Okay.
So you after that first summer, you stayed in Skagway, and what was the first thing you did for Bob's Booty that fall?
Let's see, the first time I worked for Bob was starting in about March of 84.
Oh, okay.
And I just spent a month working on him on, I can't tell you what the short-term project was.
Was it the I know you worked on Dai stuff.
Yeah, in both 85 and 86, I worked on various, I'd call them vignettes, short reports having to do with the Dai and the Chilkoot Trail. That eventually became an informal report. In 85, I did primarily reports about Dai, and then in 86, I kind of walked up the Chilkoot Trail and wrote reports about that. I now remember in 84, what Bob asked me to do was to create a map showing what Dai looked like during the Gold Rush. And the reason this was important to him was nobody really knew how geographically Dai was laid out. There were no existing plat maps or any other accurate maps that showed the totality of what Dai looked like.
I'm surprised.
Dai, there was in the magistrate's book a grid map showing Dai between the wharf area and about 6th or 7th Street. Once you got beyond that, was a Camp Dai military reservation, and just beyond that was the Indian village, and beyond that there was kind of a suburban or northern end of Dai with the main street, I think it was called River Street, and possibly one other street a little farther inland that wound all the way to the far northern end of town, which is where you would angle over and cross the Taya River, and you know you got out onto the trail itself. But nobody had ever tried to take all the information that had been gathered about Dai and try to spatially put it onto a map. So that's what I did in 84. What I had done during the winter of 83-84 is I had gone into the magistrate's books and had gone through all of the various grantor-grantee index guides to find out where all the businesses were and where were they, I'm being redundant here. Where were they located, and what kind of hints could that give me in terms of how the town was laid out? So there were a lot of extraneous pieces in there that I tried to create the best kind of corporate whole as I could. I found out later, and this was probably 10 to 12 years later, that the map that I created needed to be compressed just a little bit in the middle of town, but all in all it was a pretty good rendition of what it is. Now what's happened in more recent years is the archaeologists have gotten out there and through a number of pretty sophisticated methods have been able to find out where the streets were, where certain businesses may have been located, and so what I did was not only create a map, but I also created kind of a business guide which tried to place where all of the businesses that were advertised or in these magistrate books or whatever, where they were located. So that later became helpful to the archaeologists when they're saying, you know, I ran across this scatter of stuff. What could it have been? And sometimes I was more conclusive than at other times, but at least it gave them some evidence to go on.
Well, so the magistrate records, how does that tell you what a business is and where it's located?
Well, because the grantor-grantee indexes, essentially saying, you know, I gave my property from person X to person Y, they would have to say where this place was. And in almost every case, it was on the east side of 3rd Street, north of River Street or something like that. They didn't have street numbers. And oftentimes they would be given in reference to like one of the major hotels in town. The Olympic Hotel was by far the largest hotel in town. But there were certain other places that they would use as kind of demarcation points. And so using a lot of these other kind of rough relative terms, you just try to mix and match and put things together as best as you could.
And were there old newspapers that had advertisements that you could
look
up?
There, and I'd say a primary method that I used in this business guide and map was either the Dyea Press or the Dyea Trail. And both of them had, you know, one of them published only during 1898 and the other one in both 98 and 99. To be honest, Dyea was, you know, it was an active town, but it had an effective life of about 8 or 10 months.
Yeah.
Because once the decision was made over on the Skagway side to start building that railroad, everybody in Dyea knew that its days were numbered.
Right.
I guess I should say the 97 and early 98 were days of wild speculation in which there were probably 30 or 40 companies that announced their intention to build a railroad. Most of these were stock market scams. But what was obviously different about the White Pass, it had London money, and it had Mike Heaney, who was a construction contractor who saw to it that working with the Close Brothers of London, they got a railroad built over, through some very treacherous terrain.
Okay. Well, I was just thinking about the businesses in Dyea and how you figure all that out, because a lot of it may have just been a tent. They didn't necessarily have a building.
Most of them were tents. Yeah. There were tents, there were log cabins, there were frame buildings. This Olympic Hotel that I mentioned, I don't know if it was built on site, but after the gold rush, the whole thing was loaded onto a raft and taken down to Douglas.
Oh.
And later became a hotel down there for another 15 years or so.
And as you say, the town itself was pretty short-lived. I would think some of those businesses didn't last the whole 2 years. You know, they were there.
Oh, most of them lasted 2 months, five
yeah.
months. I mean, because people would open up a business in a tent or a kind of a rough log building, and then they'd head for Dawson too.
Yeah.
And it's not surprising that there are certain business names that we saw not first in Dyea and later in Sheep Camp and later in Dawson.
Or it was the same business that then somebody else took over. Says, I'm leaving here, you run it now.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like incredibly difficult to figure out what those businesses were and where they were.
And
did you use photographs?
Oh, yeah.
Well?
The photographs were hugely helpful. And once again, I have to thank Bob for having, you know, gone to the major archival sources in Alaska, in Washington State, in Fort Worth, Texas, in D.C., and other places to, assemble a really very good series of photographs.
That was one of my questions, is how the Klondike photo collection came to be. Bob went out and acquired images.
Yeah. Bob was the chief architect of that. I think others since that time have made small incremental changes.
Right.
I spent a week at the Public Archives of Canada in the late 80s, and at other times, you know, There have been additional newspapers that have come on and incremental changes, but Bob is largely responsible.
Well, and certainly since probably in the 70s when the park started, and then since then, individuals show up with family collections of
Absolutely.
Things. But in terms of the archival ones, this is a question for Bob, is how do you know where to go look for these photos?
Actually, one additional item of help we had is back in the late 70s and early 80s, in other words, during the years of the oil boom, the state was able to spend good chunks of money on history and archaeology, more so than they did during the oil bust and some later years. And there was a gentleman, I think his name was Dale Sterling, who provided enormous help to anyone who follows the Klondike Gold Rush, in which he sent postcards to like 900 different repositories. You know, we're talking county historical societies and genealogical societies and you know, other people anyone who may have had bits and pieces of Klondike lore. And so I guess I need to step back here and say this was not just for Klondike Gold Rush information, but he wanted to find out from relatively obscure places outside of Alaska who had good stuff about Alaska, because otherwise you just don't know. Mm-hmm. And so he put together actually two different volumes through this Alaska Commission on History. You know, he was funded, I don't know, $1,000 or something to put this stuff together.
Was he a state employee, or he did it as a contract or grant from the commission?
It was a grant from the commission. It was something different from any work he may have been doing for the state.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. So you did that Gaiyi thing. You also worked on, what do I want to call it, historic surveys, HRSs, or whatever you call those? Did you do some of those in Skagway?
Well, one thing I did, I worked on National Register nominations.
Right.
And Bob asked me to revise the National Historic Landmark nomination for Skagway and White Pass. I guess I also wrote a National Register nomination for Dyea and the Chilkoot Trail. The Dyea Chilkoot Trail one was bureaucratically fairly easy to do because I'm trying to remember, but that one was the revision was approved fairly readily by the keeper of the National Register. Once again, you're kind of making me think about this stuff for the first time in a long time. I think that Dyea and the Chilkoot Trail had a National Register nomination. I don't think the NHL nomination ever was approved. So bureaucratically, I was writing an NHL nomination for the first time.
And so an NHL, the landmark nomination, would have been for the whole region? It would have had a broader scope?
For the whole corridor between Dyea and the top of Chilkoot Pass.
Okay.
What complicated things on the Skagway side were two major factors. First, there was an existing NHL nomination that had been approved way back in like 1963. The first NHLs were in 1960, and on the heels of that, there was kind of a top list of NHL possibilities in which various people put together kind of quickie versions of NHLs for what everybody recognized were some of the most important historical properties in the country. And the Skagway White Pass NHL nomination was about 4 pages long. Okay? It covered the waterfront. This was back in the days even before the National Historic Preservation Act was passed of 1966. And so there really weren't any criteria or very sophisticated methodology about how to put these things done. So they wrote these, you know, these relatively brief forms, included 5 or 6 photos to go along with it, and without a lot of historical precedent to them, the Secretary of Interior signed off on them. I guess it was Stuart Udall at the time, or one of his assistants, and it became implemented. By the mid-1980s, there had been a pretty large and fairly sophisticated bureaucracy going on with what's needed in a form like this. And besides, because we had a park that had been established and we knew a lot more about these trails, what had been a 4 or 5 page report turned into about a 60 page report with 30 photographs. And there were various committees that all wanted to have their hand in seeing what was in it and how it should be worded and that kind of thing. We, and when I say we, I mean Bob and I, turned in what we thought was a pretty good version of a Skagway White Pass nomination. And let's face it, Bob knew way more about the bureaucracy. I was just there to, you know, input information. By the time that got approved and implemented the revision, I think it took 14 years.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was many years after I had started in the Anchorage office. But
so it is now a registered national landmark.
Yeah, as of about 2000. And in fact, that came in very, very handy over the years, because in about 2005, there was a concerted push to build a highway from Juneau to Skagway, and it would have involved having a road coming from the Lower Dewey area kind of sliding down into town. It would have been a massive construction effort, and it would have, in my opinion, grossly disfigured the landscape setting of Skagway. And largely because of the existence of that NHL, that effort was stopped.
Well, it's still under discussion.
Okay.
Well, I don't know about that particular route, but a road to Juneau comes up every once in a while.
It's probably one of those perennial garden variety. If you're a boomer, you want to see a road between Skagway and Juneau.
Right. Yeah. So, but it's nice to know that having that landmark status might help protect it. But I'm looking at the transcript from your 88 interview, and you're talking about that you did a historic structure report for the Chilkoot Trail.
Okay. The historic structures report is that compilation of, I would say, 30 write-ups on various places in Dyea and along the Chilkoot Trail.
Okay.
There were probably 8 or 10 write-ups of various individual structures around Dyea. For instance, there was a facade for the A.M. Gregg Real Estate Office. And what had taken place in the mid-70s is some Skagway folks had come out. They had wandered around Dyea and had seen this front wall, which was in pretty good shape. Now, knowing the destructive qualities of freeze and thaw and of damp ground and of you know, snow melting on it, they lifted that facade up, you know, and gave it a little more structural integrity, I think probably by adding a couple of 2x4s on the sides. And then once it had been propped up, they had kind of a horizontal bar that they hooked into a couple of local tree branches so that it would stay up. And believe me, if they had not done that, that resource would probably not be here today.
Yeah.
Because there's very little in terms of major constituent stuff.
Right.
All, you know.
And those were private people who did that, or the Park Service?
I think, it was just private people.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not sure if you've spoken to a fellow named John Jackson.
I did.
Okay. We call him JJ. And he had various jobs around town when I was living there. And he was one of the people that, that took care of that.
Oh, I didn't know that. He talked about moving the cemetery.
Oh, he did. He was part of that crew too. Okay. And that was necessitated because there was a perception that the Taya River was going to come through and undercut all of that, that cemetery.
Mm-hmm. And now, was the Patterson Cabin there, or what's called the Patterson Cabin now?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the Hosford Sawmill, was there anything left of that? Because I think you've written about it, or maybe Bob wrote about it.
Well, it was in a lot better shape in the early 80s than it was in the late 80s.
Yeah.
And when I walked by in 2011, I hiked the trail just a few years ago, and it had pretty well crumbled away. Keep in mind that the Hosford Sawmill, while having some historical importance, was not built until the 50s or 60s. So.
Well, nowadays the 50s is historically important.
Well, you're right, but also the Park Service always has these periods of significance that we need to worry about.
Right.
And we oftentimes interpret certain buildings at a slightly different time than at other buildings. But in general, most things that the Park Service cares about most greatly started in about 1887, which is when the Captain Moore Cabin was built. And lasts until about 1906, 1908, something like that.
Right, for that's sort of the mission or the focus of the Klondike Park is that period.
Well, the remarkable characteristic of Skagway is that a huge amount of building and activity took place between 1887 and 1908, and with about two or three exceptions, that town did not change at all in terms of new building until 1947.
Right, but they moved a lot of buildings, which I find fascinating.
They did.
That I don't know that that's common in other communities, that you move things around like that.
I can't answer that question.
Well, so that the Chilku Trail, what was that like in the early 80s? What was the...
Okay, the Chilku Trail was begun, was essentially recreated... starting in 1961 through the Division of Adult and Youth Authority of the state of Alaska. And over about a four-year period, the U.S. side, the trail on the U.S. side was routed out by people, various people from the Youth Authority, not based on a lot of sophisticated historical research, but if they found chunks of the what they thought of as the historical trail, they used it. Most of the first 6 or 7 miles between Dyea and Canyon City, they did not use existing trail. So one of the ongoing jobs that we had as sort of incipient historians and archaeologists in the 1980s was to find to the greatest extent possible where the historical Chilku Trail was. And we were more successful in some cases than in others. Because the Lower Taya River was periodically flooded over the years, one of the best bits of evidence that we found was, in fact, I was on an archaeological crew with Carl Gerke on this, there were a number of insulators that were nailed into trees where a phone line would follow the trail itself. And it was those insulators that helped guide us to, perceive locations of the wagon road, because the wagon road had gone all the way from Dyea to Canyon City and then had stopped at Canyon City, right where the canyon narrows and gets really steep.
Oh, so the Stampeders could have their supplies hauled in by wagon up to Canyon City?
There were some that did, yeah. And
the rich ones, maybe.
And there weren't a lot of rich ones.
Yeah.
Those probably would have been businessmen or wealthy people that wanted to establish stores in Dawson City and, would either use a wagon or hire a lot of packers, most of whom were native, not all of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I was wondering, how do you find where the historic trail is? But you, well, those insulators, but were there other clues that you were looking for?
There were places where the actual metal of the telephone line could be found, usually under a lot of duff.
Yeah.
So that helped too. So, yeah, it was the summer of 1986 where Carl and a fellow named Scott, sorry, don't remember his last name, and it would be in the book, and I kind of, we made a lot of horizontal weaving transcripts through the Devil's Club and whatever the other vegetation was out there.
Alder, probably.
Yeah, alder and willow, and yeah. We got up face-to-face with nature. We walked between Dai and Finnegan's that summer. We may have gotten a bit beyond there, and then later crews continued farther on up the trail
mm-hmm.
in later years.
So with all the historical research, did you also talk to local residents?
There's about a 60-year gap there between when people started heading out on the trail again and when the gold rush took place. There was one old-timer in town who I found very valuable. His name is George Rapuzzi. Bob had interviewed him a number of times in the late 70s. George had, and I interviewed him three times, I think it was. George is somebody who worked for the railroad. I think he worked in, I'm not going to be able to tell you which section. I think it was bridge and building, but I'm not sure. But he was quite the hiker and sort of entrepreneur in that area. So he, for instance, climbed Mount Harding shortly after it was, President Harding came there mm-hmm. in 1923, and I think within a year or so, he and some buddies, you know, paddled across the bay and climbed on up. Other people, he also had led a film crew up toward Chilkoot Pass sometime in the early to mid-20s. Of course, the film The Gold Rush with Charlie Chaplin in there, its Chilkoot Pass scene was in around Truckee and you know, the Donner Pass
right.
area of California. But either for that effort or perhaps for some other effort, somebody said they wanted to make a film about Chilkoot Pass. The film was never made, but George led people up to Chilkoot Pass and apparently seeing the real thing wasn't right for them. It also meant, you know, hiking 13 miles
right.
up a trail that didn't exist.
Right, and Truckee and Donner Pass you could drive to.
Or take a train or, right. yeah, it was way more accessible.
Right. So what was George like? Because by the time you interviewed him, he was probably quite elderly.
Yeah, George died in 86, and the beauty of George is that he both had a very good memory, and he also kept a pretty substantial museum of gold rush related artifacts. He had he collected things sometimes for collecting's sake,
yeah.
and I'm sure there are people at the park who can yeah. tell you in intimate detail
oh, yes.
about exactly what it was, but. When I knew him, he was very giving and open about showing me the kind of stuff he had, but there was a huge overburden of old car parts, of construction materials, and other things that I would call, you know, just kind of dross. But he knew where some of the more valuable gold rush related materials were, and so we'd climb in and around
mm-hmm.
this stuff. It was kept in the either in the old Soapy Smith's parlor or in what was called the Meyer Building / YMCA
right.
at the time. And,
yeah.
and that's where he kept his car, you know, his itching
right.
tour.
Well, I was just wondering what George was like as a person, since not so, the Rapuzzi collection is part of the park now and is a big deal, but
yeah.
he was long gone by the time many of the people who worked with the collection came along. So I was wondering.
He was craggy and independent. You know, he called a spade a spade, and you know, I don't think he was wild about the idea of the Park Service coming in, and because he kind of ran the show there for about 10 years there, you know, during between the mid six, the early 60s and the early 70s, he showed his Soapy Smith's Parlor to a number of people, kind of in his early retirement years and maybe as part of his late working years as well. He would arrange to have it open. And, there was a fascinating collection of stuff, which is kind of belongs in sort of a homemade, cute era that a more sophisticated tourist might not appreciate. But for somebody who would have come off of a small cruise ship or had, you know, somehow made it into town on a ferry boat or something like that, and you kind of had the place to yourself, it was quirky and really quite appealing in its own way.
Well, you know, there's plenty of small town little historical society museums or private things around the country that it's sort of an odd mishmash collection. It doesn't fit the professional standards of museum exhibits.
Yeah.
You know, and that's okay.
Yeah.
It has its place.
Okay. Well, and people would arrive in town essentially looking for someone to say, hey, show me what this town has got.
Right.
And you're going to be at the behest of whoever does the showing.
Right.
And George was really very good with mechanics. Martin Itchen, who I think there had been kind of a brotherly or father and son kind of relationship between Martin Itchen and George, because a lot of that stuff was deeded to George.
Mm-hmm.
Martin died in 42, I think it was, and I'm sure he knew him quite well from those days. And in fact, George had a number of press clippings that Martin had gathered. Apparently he had signed on to a subscription service so that when he took his car down to Hollywood and met with Mae West and such, you know, he was able to get all of the different papers' renditions of how that, you know, kind of cutesy interview ended up.
I was just going to say about George and I just totally forgot what I was going to say.
But George, regardless of any feelings he may have had for the Park Service, was quite cooperative with Bob, and you know, he was a little on the gruff side, but he was cooperative with me as well.
Yeah, that was what I was going to ask, was the feelings towards the Park Service, and you think sort of building rapport with George on a personal level helped?
Well, in fact, on kind of a larger extent, in the early 80s, some people in Alaska, as well as in Skagway, really had very antagonistic ideas toward the National Park Service. The Alaska Lands Bill had passed in December of 1980 after a long, almost decade-long fight. And a lot of people that were longtime Alaskans really didn't like the idea of a major federal presence and of the creation of a lot of, you know, huge parks, preserves, wilderness areas, this kind of thing. And they didn't understand and didn't appreciate this huge movement in the lower 48 about wanting to save large portions of Alaska. But there's also a recognition that, and I saw it time again, where people would say, I don't like the Park Service, but I like you. And I may not like what the Park Service is doing, but we bowl every Friday night over at the Elks Lodge, so let's get along together as best as we can. And virtually everybody in town, if they didn't like me or like the Park Service, they kept their feelings to themselves. And this may have popped up at certain times at city council meetings or, you know, in conversations over at Moe's Bar or what have you, but I was always treated very respectfully, with one exception, and you know, you just kind of toss it off and let it go. There was a hunter in town named Jay Fry who was always very polite to me, and he once, you know, told me, you know, I wish the Park Service wasn't here, but you know, there's nothing I can do about it, and you know, I think you're a nice guy. So that kind of attitude was probably pretty common.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I've heard stories, or it's in your admin history, I guess, is, you know, that in the early days, you know, the 70s when the park first started having a presence, that there was quite a bit of animosity from the community.
Yeah. There was a study done of, a very early study done, I think through the Denver Service Center. It's called Skagway, A Study of Alternatives. And one of those alternatives, which was reflected in the, I think, feasibility study, or master plan, I think it was called, in 1971, was to take a number of White Pass locomotives and have them as a standing display in the middle of Broadway.
Well, it was to recreate when the tracks went down the middle of Broadway.
That's right. And some planner thought that this was going to be sort of a historical recreation, and you know, we were laughed at a lot, you know, for things like that. Mm-hmm. We did the best we could to work with the existing authorities, and I think it's really to our to the good over the long run that there were a number of people that were in town early on that went out of their way to, you know, have coffee with local residents, to be around so that if people had questions, you know, in other words, there were a number of people that were the face of the National Park Service who were nice guys. Mm-hmm. And I say nice guys because most, if not all of them, were men in the early days. Mm-hmm. And they comported themselves well. They didn't try any kind of top-down approach saying, I'm from the government and we're going to make you do X, Y, and Z. So I think that, you know, that really helped in terms of getting people to accept the Park Service. Also, we hired a number of local people. Mm-hmm. And particularly after the railroad closed down, the town's perception of the Park Service went way up, saying, we may not like these guys, but they're putting beans and rice on our mm-hmm. on our table.
Yeah, it did provide a lot of employment with that historic building restoration work.
That's right, yeah.
And I mean, I think you're right that the individual employees building trust with individuals in the community, I can see that would have helped.
Yeah.
And employees who stayed and lived there and made that their home, like you did for a number of years.
Yeah.
You think that helped?
As a seasonal, I would say that people could sort of take me or leave me as they wished, and probably some of them expected me to head off on the next boat. Because after all, I mean, it was not all that common for someone in a seasonal position to stick around as long as I did.
Right.
I think a lot of these perceptions had to do with, you know, who's the superintendent, who's the chief ranger, and most of those people went out of their way to try to meet locals halfway, and if they sensed that something was sort of collectively bothering the local townsfolk, you know, they would find ways to meet with the mayor, with council people, with the head of the railroad, with other city leaders, and try to meet them halfway.
Right, and you say the superintendent would be particularly the face of the Park Service. So what was Dick Sims like as a superintendent? What was his management and his relationships with the community?
I think I'll skip that question.
Okay.
I mean, I have my own private reasons, and He was an okay superintendent. Okay. I would not call him glorious.
Okay. During his tenure, what was the relationship like between the park and the community? Can you talk about that?
Well, once again, I suppose it depends on which part of the community you're talking about, but while the railroad was still running up until October of 82, I think a lot of people regarded the park as being, you know, sort of the federal government, and there was probably a level of annoyance because it, as long as the railroad was running, everybody was working, and the, mm-hmm. The town was really in pretty prosperous, a really pretty prosperous position. Once the railroad shut down, and Dick was the superintendent, you know, at that time, people looked to the Park Service and, you know, saw us in a different light.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that in the early day, when the park first started and they were buying buildings, there was the perception that they were going to take over the whole town and make it, you know, this sort of Disneyland, quote
sure.
unquote. Now, was that during Sims' administration or that was Hoffman?
Most of that Hoffman dealt with, and you know, and a lot of what I'm telling you is kind of stories that I had heard
right.
from previously.
Right.
I didn't show up there until 8 months after the railroad had shut down.
Right. Well, that's why I was asking about what you'd heard about previous, because maybe it's in your admin history or something, but that there was this sense that the Park Service was just taking over, and I don't know if that was a superintendent giving that impression or that was just misinformation on the part of residents, and what you may have heard about that.
I don't think that any superintendent ever tried to be a strong man, and in fact, both the superintendents and, you know, chief rangers, architects, other people who would be kind of the face of the Park Service, went out of their way because it's a difficult concept for an agency to create a park in which we own building A, B, C, and D, but not E, F, G, and H.
Right.
And so this is kind of a new idea. And so people thought, well, if you're going to draw a line around the downtown area, I guess that means the Park Service either, you know, owns it now or plans to own it. And this idea that we would take some buildings and turn them into interpretive vehicles, but buy other buildings, spend, you know, a couple of million dollars on renovating it, and then rent it out for, you know, somebody's curio shop. This was new not only in Skagway, but in the Park Service. I mean, it's just not the kind of thing that people did.
Right. So how did they figure it out? Trial and error, or did they
just by doing, I mean.
Yeah, there was no model to look at.
Yeah, I mean, I think the history goes into there were a whole series of iterations in which Park Service professionals, some of them planners, some of them historians, I know Bill Brown was a historian that took a major role in this, and others, they tossed around, well, which building would be good for what kind of purpose? You know, some buildings weren't big enough to really do much with, you know, the Goldberg Cigar Store or the Martin Itchen House. You know, should we move any of them? Because the Itchen House was moved down to, you know, down to its location from another place. You know, how many of these should simply be static displays? Would people be interested in renting out building, you know, certain buildings, and it was usually some of the larger buildings that we rented out, like Lynch and Kennedy is a pretty sizable structure.
Yeah.
So I think people just kind of made it up and as best as they could, but as you see in the admin history, a number of these buildings first were deemed to have one potential purpose, but as time went on, those purposes changed.
Right. I was just looking again at this transcript. There's a name mentioned here I wanted to ask you about. Paul Sinsek, is that?
Sinsek, yeah.
And who was he?
Let's see. I had a chance to talk to Paul when he was down in Douglas, you know, near Juneau.
Mm-hmm.
He had seen to it and I don't know how he got them, but he was able to find a real treasure trove of old photographs and sort of ensure that they continued to live. I mean, they were found in somebody's attic or behind a wall or something like that. To the best of my knowledge, and Bob can give you a better answer than I can, I think he worked for the railroad, but he really enjoyed working with the local museum as well, the Trail of 98 Museum.
Well, yeah, you say you're the Trail of 98 Museum. What was that? That's not the current City Museum, is it?
That is the City Museum.
Oh, okay, that's what it's called.
And it was located in City Hall.
Okay.
Yeah.
But now it's in the old college building. Is that the same museum you're talking about?
That's the same thing. I mean,
oh, okay.
In my perception, when I was there in the 80s,
that was where City Hall was.
The museum was on the second floor of the old McCabe College building,
right.
and on the first floor was the city manager's office. You'd walk in, and that meeting room was where the city council meetings would be. And there's a little shoebox of a building right behind there where the magistrate's office was. A lady named Jean Worley was the magistrate at that time, and she had all these historical volumes of court records and deed books and mm-hmm. all kinds of things. And I spent a lot of that winter of 83-84 just kind of working with Jean and going through there. Mm-hmm. And then she'd rig me up with some table or bench or something in the city hall chambers, and I'd just work from there.
Right. So Paul was, create that Trail of 98 Museum, or he was just...
No, the Trail of 98 Museum was established back in about 63, and I think I make a reference to that. But I think he may have directed the museum for a while. He was not in Skagway by the time I showed up,
right.
But, you know, everybody knew him, and you know, people told me about what his contributions had been.
Mm-hmm. Because, so when you were there, who was the head of the city museum? Was that Glenda?
Well, Glenda never ran the museum.
Okay.
She did some contract work. Her major job with the museum was she inventoried everything in
and
the museum.
And we should say Glenda Choate.
Choate,
right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And Glenda, she wore a lot of hats. She was a historian. She was an archivist. You know, she did various kinds of consulting work, but in 1980, I think it was, she was asked to take all of the flat materials in the museum and kind of process them, list them, inventory them, put what was really necessary in acid-free folders, that kind of thing like
mm-hmm.
that. So by the time I came along, it was far more manageable and easy, because there was an index guide as well as, you know, the volumes themselves. And while I didn't use city archival stuff a lot, it was really nice to know that it was there. What I did do oftentimes is, in one corner of the museum were all of the grantor grantee index books for all of the properties in town. You know, in other words, not the stuff that was in the magistrate's office, but for instance, I could go upstairs and for any parcel in town, by simply going through all of the annual property tax deeds, I could find out who owned property every year from 1900 to, you know, the present. And I could also find out how much people paid in property taxes and whether they were improved or not. This is enormously valuable to someone, you know, in the kind of work that I was doing, where I was often trying to find out, you know, how old a certain building was, because,
mm-hmm.
you know, a year after that, you know, you'd start paying for the improvements on it.
Right. And then, so when you were there, Glenda was she as the one that you worked with to find materials?
No.
No.
A lady named Eileen Rolf, R-O-H-L-F, was the curator of the museum. And she was kind of an old school museum curator. She felt that the job of the museum was to you know, was to spray down the display cases and you know, and to open the door. And, you know, she was not exactly, you know, she didn't insist on the latest, you know, museum quality curation techniques. Mm-hmm. But then again, the museum had a number of excellent 3D items that had been donated by local families, and tourists seemed to really enjoy going there.
Yeah, I don't know what their exhibits are like now. They've changed since the 80s.
I would hope so.
I don't know.
Yeah.
So the other projects that you did with Bob, so we talked about Dai and the trail.
Yeah.
You did the gardens book, but that was a separate project. Right?
And another separate project I did was working with Dave Neufeld from Parks Canada to write a history of the Chilkoot Trail.
Okay.
Yeah, the book came out in 96, and it was called Chilkoot Trail, Heritage Route to the Klondike.
Oh yeah, I've seen it.
Okay. And it was a challenge because I was working in Anchorage, he was working in Whitehorse, and at that time email had just come out, but you couldn't attach anything to emails.
Yeah.
So whenever we wanted to send anything substantial between each other, there was a bus once a week that would go between Whitehorse and Anchorage. It's kind of this low rent affair, and so, you know, we'd work that probably happened 5 or 6 times, I guess.
And now, was Dave, I know his name, is he a historian with Parks Canada, or he was the trail ranger guy? I can't remember.
He's now retired, but I think he's still living in Whitehorse.
Yeah, he is.
And he was the designated historian for all of Yukon Territory.
Oh, okay.
For Parks Canada. And of course, Parks Canada has had a number of different names and incarnations over the years. Sometimes it's been called Environment Canada, Parks, but we just call it Parks Canada.
Well, I'm surprised that a history of the trail had not been done prior to that.
Well, and it was kind of an odd way of approaching it because this was something that both bureaucracies allowed us to do, even though what was going to come out of it was going to be a commercially available product. I mean, typically anything done by the Park Service, we work through GPO.
Government Printing Office.
Yep. And we ask for maybe 100 copies, maybe 300 copies. We give them out to people that we think are interested in, and we are not interested in making any money off of it, because any money that would be made would just go into the general fund anyway.
Right.
I mean, it's not, the idea of a book making money is just kind of foreign to us. So we were able to get, or Sandy was able to steer through and get the necessary clearances and have us work together. And you know, I spent most of a year, I guess. But Dave and I working together worked out very, very well, because there were certain things about the trail where he was the master on the Canadian side and I was, you know, the chief cook and bottle washer on the American side. But for instance, when it came to native influences and impacts, he knew more about my side than I did. And when it came to tourism and more modern years, I knew more about the Canadian side than he did.
Interesting.
So, but he knew a lot. I mean, he'd been there up there since 85, I think it was. And so the book really kind of wrote itself, and nothing substantial of any kind of reaching out to the public had ever been done about the Chilkoot Trail.
Yeah, that surprises me.
Well, but like I said, you know, when I showed up, the park had only been around for 7 years, and you know, there had been some kind of parochial or sort of homemade efforts to go ahead and write about Skagway and the Gold Rush. Of course, you know, you had Pierre Burton,
right.
And I, leaving the Gold Rush aside, most people talked about the totality of the Gold Rush and considered the Chilkoot and the trail experience, you know, a chapter or
right.
Perhaps a little more. And they loved the, you know, focus on Soapy Smith and all the
right.
the chicanery along the trails. And we were a little more technical and a little more even-handed. And from what I've heard, that book is still being printed.
And did the work you did previously on the trail with the surveys and all that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I didn't use it on a verbatim basis, but some of the items I created, like that business guide and map,
mm-hmm.
a lot of that was just picked up and transformed and plunked down.
Right.
And other of it just became kind of the basis for the narrative about the trail.
And I would think a book like that, the narrative is more narrative, whereas your historic structures report might be a little dry for a general audience.
I think you would be correct. I also think that it was, we wrote it through Lost Moose Press, and they had people in Whitehorse who looked over what we wrote and probably had a chance to goose up some of, you know, the language that
mm-hmm.
Dave and I wrote.
Mm-hmm. And then the Gardens book, how mm-hmm. did that come about?
I'm trying to remember. Let's see. The word came out that the Alaska Association of Garden Clubs was going to be meeting in Skagway at the end of a certain year, and I can't remember what it was.
I can maybe tell you, because it was around well, you said the Garden Club was formed in 83.
Okay.
So it was somewhere after that.
I'm going to say, because it was while I was living there, so it was probably either 86 or 87, something like that.
Right. And because this interview was 88 and it had already happened, so.
Okay. But what took place was during that first winter that I was there, I not only spent a lot of time going through all those deed books, but I also went through all of the early newspapers of
right.
both Dyea and Skagway. And there were certain topics that I was really quite curious about. And I had lots of time on my hands. And I was in a position where I ended up putting together just random notes about 8 or 10 topics. And that was the best thing that ever happened to me, because that provided kind of a bank of information, which for years and years afterwards, I was able to draw off on. And as a result, one of the things that I was curious about is just kind of my canvassing of these newspapers, I was curious about gardens. So I probably had 60 or 80 little line item notes, you know, taken from all these day-to-day things. I knew pretty much from day one there that Skagway, that the gardens in Skagway were a big deal for a while. Because,
yeah, they used to call themselves the Garden City of Alaska, right?
Well, what happened is during the 20s, 30s, 40s, the Canadian Pacific boats would come up the Inside Passage. They would stop in Ketchikan, Wrangell, Juneau, whatever, for 5 or 6 hours. But when they got to Skagway, they stopped and they spent a night there. Now, people would spend the night on board their ship, but for 2 days, they were looking for something to do in this dinko little town.
Right.
So as a result, there was this enhanced need for somebody to do something. And a number of people who had been there ever since the gold rush were really good gardeners and were just really proud of what they did. And so a number of those, Charlie Walker, the Blanchards, and 3 or 4 others, would go ahead and open up their gardens and have people, you know, wander through them during their time off the CP boats. So this is what I think brought about the moniker Garden City of Alaska, and a number of these gardens really became pretty well known, and they also became featured parts of Martin Itchen's streetcar tour around
mm-hmm.
town. So I used those notes and that kind of the knowledge that Skagway was known for its gardens to just kind of go out there and find out anything I could about not only gardens, but some of the Dyea farms as well,
mm-hmm.
and put it into a book that I remember I worked through Charlotte Jewell, who was the head of the Skagway Garden Club at the time. And I think she paid me something.
But you didn't do that as part of your Park Service work?
No, it was totally a side job. And what I did was I had, you know, essentially a double-spaced manuscript that I gave to Charlotte to be there in time for the garden convention. I don't remember if I gave a presentation to the convention or what I did, but Charlotte wanted that, you know, that manuscript, and then I probably gave references to a number of photos. It wasn't until, I'm going to say 10 years after that, that Jeff wrote to me saying, through my Lynn Canal Press, which is, you know, kind of the thing through my newspaper, I'd like to work together with Demetra and put together a it's kind of a historical chronicle, and then also interview a number of the biggest gardeners in town these days, talk about some of the present day gardens, and then Demetra would take pictures of a lot of the present day gardens. We'd taken some of those historical photos, and you know, all that early stuff that I wrote could be feathered in there.
Right, and we should say it's Demetra Lavrakis, who worked for Jeff Brady in the newspaper for a while.
Skagway News, thank you.
Yes, and I did wonder in that book why there didn't seem to be a history of Jewel Gardens mentioned in a book about the gardens of Skagway, and I wonder why.
I can't answer that question. Because anything that was not historically related was not really, you know, my...
So Jewel Gardens was too new, is what it was after your period of significance?
From when I've looked at the Jeff's book, I think that there is some reference to Charlotte's garden. It's right there at the turn of the highway, just on the other side of the river, isn't that right?
Yeah.
And I think there's a reference to it, but it may not have been called that or be as big as it is. I mean, I have no idea what it looks like these days.
So when you were there in the 80s, was Jewel Gardens a thing?
No.
Oh,
okay. She was running a jewelry shop.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You know, she had a baby and she loved a garden, and I'm sure she had a garden in her own house, but she didn't take it to the next level and open up. No, this whole thing out at what we would call Seven Pastures was the area just on the other side of the bridge. That didn't exist when I was there.
Okay, so maybe that's why it's not in the book, because maybe it didn't exist yet.
Well, it would have been something that was probably established between when I left town and when Demetra and I and Jeff did the book.
Right. The other sort of big topic in Klondike Park is the White Pass unit.
Okay.
So did you worked on some documentation of the White Pass?
In 1986, we had just had a new superintendent. His name was Clay Alderson. And one thing led to another, and I was able to find some snippets from, I don't know, it was a deed book or somewhere, that showed that White Pass Trail crossed the Canadian border at a certain point. And so I love the hike and kind of get lost in the weeds anyway. And I'm always looking for a different place to, you know, and if I can combine a hike with a little historical explanation. So what I did was I drove to the top of the highway White Pass, and it takes about 45 minutes or so to walk through the kind of tundra fields from the highway White Pass over to the railroad White Pass. You're going east. And then east of there, I'd seen on this map that showed that the trail of 97, and keep in mind that the trail of 97 looked different from the trail of 98 on the White Pass side.
Yeah.
Oh,
I didn't know that.
That the trail of 97, which crossed the Canadian border about a mile east of the railroad White Pass, was, that I knew about where to look for the line, and also that the border is marked by these pretty impressive stone towers, you know, that might be 6 feet high or something like that. And I think they were put up by a boundary survey in, I don't know, 1911 or something like that. So I was able to find that stone obelisk, and sure enough, within a few feet of that obelisk, I could see absolutely clear markings of where a trail had been. And you're way up above timberline there, so you can follow this thing. And it was really quite exciting to me to see that you know, that the trail was there. And because it's so remote, both from the railroad as well as the highway, nobody had been over there. You know, I'm sure some people had, but to a relative degree, it was an untouched resource. And so I found shoes, and I found, you know, other Gold Rush era paraphernalia. And I followed it all the way back down to where the bushes got high enough that you really couldn't follow it anymore. And that was right around the 18A tunnel. 18A tunnel is right near what we would call the 18A bridge, which is this abandoned but very beautiful trestle structure that crosses the upper Skagway River. So based on that, I think I followed that up by trying to find ways to get down to White Pass City, and I did that at one point, and we wandered around. A lady named Carolyn Carley had done some archaeological work in White Pass City during the summer of 1979. And I also, kind of following along on this same thematic bent, I also did a good deal of clambering around on the west side of the Klondike Highway, right around the customs station, which was probably about 5 miles, 6 miles, somewhere in there, because the old maps unmistakably showed that that the Trail of 97 went through this area. And I was really hoping to be able to find pictures of that, because we really didn't have a very good idea about where the Trail of 97 went. We know very well where the Trail of 98 goes, because that is the Bracket Wagon Road and its extension. And beyond White Pass City, which is where the Bracket Wagon Road stopped, it kind of went right up that kind of narrow neck that connects White Pass City and the top of the pass, where the railroad goes. But try as I may, I went a number of times doing transects from the border station area up Porcupine Creek and in other areas, and I never found kind of proof positive of where that trail went or any evidence that goes with it. I thought I knew for a while, and maybe I found some things, but it was never conclusive.
What about the Bracket Wagon Road? Did you find evidence of its route?
It's real easy to find. And you know, today I can go out and, you know, it was a 10-foot wide road that wagons served White Pass City for about a year or so. In fact, there's a book, I think, available in bookstores in which somebody was able to find a bunch of photos from a special collection that shows a lot of George Bracket and his wagon making activities. So starting at about 7.4 mile, below that there's a scree slope that you lose out on, but all the way from about 7.4 mile all the way to where you drop down into White Pass City, you can walk on it today.
I didn't realize, why did the Bracket Road end at White Pass? Why didn't it keep going? White Pass City, I mean.
Because by April of 98, which is as far as he'd gotten, the Gold Rush was winding down. Mm-hmm. And I think he could see, the road, the topography really gets a lot steeper there.
And the railroad was under construction.
No, I don't think it was. What had happened, though, was the Close Brothers ended up buying out George Bracket, so that they would have exclusive use of all commercial travel over there. And maybe once they recognized that these guys were serious enough to buy him out, then he wasn't going to, you know, well, probably he couldn't after that point. Mm-hmm. Some of those historical details I've forgotten.
Right, but so you weren't able to do any more of a history of the White Pass trails in the unit up there?
Actually, a lady named Julie Johnson put together, it's called a Wild and Dangerous Mess?
Wild and Discouraging Mess, I think.
Exactly,
like that.
Yeah. And she, I kind of looked over her shoulder as she wrote it, because we were both in the Anchorage office at the time. And she was able to put together some really good stuff about the White Pass unit. The Park Service has never chosen to fully immerse itself in developing or interpreting the resources of the White Pass unit. I think because they feel that there needs to be a more thorough archaeological survey of both the Trail of 97 and the Trail of 98. And that has not been funded for whatever reason.
Well, that was what I was going to ask you, is whether you think there should be some more focused management like there is on the Chilkoot.
Well,
side.
I don't know if should has anything to do with it, but Carl's the person that would know.
If you think it would be beneficial, I guess maybe.
Well, what Carl did with he was appointed or given the job of being the cultural resource officer in 87. And he immediately went out to Dai and did some much more sophisticated archaeological stuff. I think he mapped the town site and then investigated certain of the more.
And you mentioned you guys worked on the Dai Wharf.
That's right.
You had done that.
And that once again was just a total lark, if you want to call it that. I took a look at the tide tables, because there's a huge tidal range in that area, and when the tide is low, you can see an awful lot of the wharf pilings there. So, and I think it was with this Scott fella as well, Scott Zimmerman?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what it says in that transcript.
Okay.
It's coming back to you.
Scott Zimmerman. What we decided to do, he had something called an EDM, which was like a sophisticated surveying instrument. Mm-hmm. And so that was able to show not only the exact number of feet and inches between point A and point B and such, but he also, how much grade and declination there was between the high point of the beach and, you know, getting down to the tide line. So we went out and, you know, I think it was early May, and of course the days are real long there, and I think we were out there by 4 in the morning or something. And we wanted to get there probably an hour before the lowest low tide, because the idea was that we wanted to be able to hold up a survey pole and measure the location of every one of the pylons that made up the Dai Wharf. And so, and that's what we did. I'm sure there are pylons that go farther than that, but, you know, it's not like we had scuba gear or anything like that.
Right.
So we put that together and then made it into a map later on.
Right. In 87, Carl became the cultural resources. He was hired as the cultural resources person.
Yeah.
Was that a job you had been interested in?
It was, yeah. And so we both applied for it, and Jay Cable, who made the decision about that, essentially said, and this is common in a number of units of the Park Service, that it's better to have an archaeologist who can do history than a historian, most of whom cannot do a lot of the very standard techniques required of archaeologists. You know, how to dig out a 1x1 meter test pit. And so for whatever, you know, Carl got that job. I continued to work for the Park Service in Skagway summer times in both 87 and 88. But by that time I was, other factors in my life had intervened. Starting in the fall of 87, I got into the PhD program at University of Washington and got married during that winter. So, you know, things just took a different turn in my life.
Mm-hmm. And so when did you left Skagway in 88?
The fall, late summer of 88.
And did you go to Anchorage to work in the regional office?
No, I was a full-time grad student.
Okay.
Between the fall of 88. Of course, that would have been the beginning of my second year of classwork there.
Mm-hmm.
I stayed in Seattle until late fall of 89 when Kate Lidfors, the regional historian, chose me to become a permanent historian up in Anchorage, and I started in Anchorage as a historian in mid-January of 1990.
Okay. And so we talked a little bit before we turned the recorder on about the difference between being cultural resources and historians based in Anchorage versus being based out in the parks.
Sure.
And you can talk a little bit about that sort of administrative history.
Well, the Alaska Lands Act, Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, was passed in early December of 1980. And one of the provisions in that act was that the Alaska Area Office became the Alaska Regional Office. Prior to the passage of ANILCA, there were, I think, just a couple of cultural resource people working in the Alaska Area Office. But having an Alaska Regional Office gave the long-term potential of building up staff. And so during the 1980s, John Cook was the regional director at the time of the passage of the Alaska Lands Act. His philosophy, recognizing the potential pitfalls of any other management course, he spent the next several years reaching out to communities and individuals, to the state and everybody, just trying to get along, not trying to play, not at all trying to be antagonistic, but trying to recognize, information and education were the key words during those years. Later regional directors, Roger Conter and then Boyd Evison, were a little more assertive in the role of the National Park Service. But John started out by being real easygoing and meeting everyone halfway. Over the 1980s, the number of staff in the Alaska Regional Office slowly built up, and there became a regional historian, a regional architect, regional archaeologist, and so on and so forth. And that number continued to climb primarily by the acquisition of a number of term personnel, many of whom were on for 4-year stints. Okay, so when I showed up, I was a permanent employee, but there were a number of people that were hired as terms. That continued until 1994, when President Clinton, as part of, as an action, primarily working with Al Gore in a reinventing government initiative, made a number of recommendations to the National Park Service, or to government agencies, which in the Park Service's case meant get people out to the parks rather than trying to operate your programs in a more centralized format. And one direct result of that is that a number of people who were term employees, and many of whom were getting ready to, who were in a pretty precarious position anyway because their terms were coming to an end, and the Park Service was having a hard time justifying keeping them as long-term term employees. They were essentially given a choice that if they wanted to work in a park, they would find a way to give them favored status to be able to become a permanent employee. But they had to leave Anchorage and move to Glen Allen or to Fairbanks or to
Healy.
Wherever the places may be, and become a head of park-based cultural resource programs. So that's what took place in 94, and we lost a lot of seasonals from the office, but the total amount of work getting done in the region didn't change appreciably because we still had most of those same people just working in more remote locations.
So most of the existing staff chose to go out to the parks instead of quitting and going doing something else?
I would say some to most, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Not all of the term employees were given the option to be able to go out to a park. And some people were ready to move on and work in private sector or for the state or for other opportunities. So it wasn't a clean process, but it's kind of sorted itself out over, I'd say, a year and a half, something like that.
And reflecting back, do you feel whether that was a successful change or not?
It's not really my call. I mean, it didn't have anything definitely to do with my particular job. It was just something that I saw while working in the regional office. Mm-hmm. I guess I could offer an opinion, but my opinion isn't any better informed than anybody else's.
Well, it's whether you saw that it was efficient and working or if there were challenges to it.
I can understand the necessity for getting people out into the parks, and I think it was a good idea that the staff at the parks had, you know, a broader series of expertise. It did make for some difficult personal circumstances in terms of housing and the remoteness of living. You know, a number of these people had lived in just places like Fairbanks and Anchorage mm-hmm. for most of their working lives.
Well, and now you were based in Anchorage working on projects, say, in Skagway. Mm-hmm. You'd been in Skagway, was that problematic to be so far away from where you were working?
Not at all, because in my position as a historian in the regional office, I had different kinds of job assignments. I mean, one of the first job assignments I had was working way out at Aniakchak National Monument out on the Alaska Peninsula. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote a short report about a fisheries building out there. At the same time, immediately after that, I wrote an administrative history of Katmai National Park and Preserve and included Aniakchak in that report. Starting about 94, I started working on the Klondike administrative history. And as part of that, I was asked to include a couple of chapters on the Seattle unit. There was kind of a side agreement made between Sandy and the Pacific Northwest Regional Office in order to allow that to happen, and I'm glad it did. Because of my knowledge of Klondike, and because there were so many records available in Anchorage about Klondike's history, the mechanical process, the logistics, were not really that difficult. I probably took a couple of field trips down there to gather specific information, but most of it was information I was able to obtain in the Anchorage office.
Well, that was one of my questions on the admin history, is just method and process and how you go about putting such a big report together and what resources you used.
Well, one thing I typically do when I finish some kind of historical study, particularly with the government, is I take all the files that I've used and then I put together kind of a finding aid guide, so that, because I know that, you know, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years down the line, other people are going to want to both find out what I know, and they'll want to know where I got the information, because a historian, if he can't reproduce the information, it's not worth very much. So as a result, I think everything about the Klondike project went into four, you know, Hollinger boxes, you know, big white ones.
Right.
In other words, bigger than banker boxes,
right,
but, you know, kind of black and white archival boxes.
Right.
And so, you know, they're labeled and with finding aids in them.
And where are they?
They should be in the down on the first floor of the Alaska Regional Office.
In their archives.
Yeah. Carl may know something that I don't, because there were at least, you know, like during the 10 years after this thing was finished, I think Carl probably at one point took one or more of those boxes and brought them back to Skagway. But to the best of my knowledge, there's Alaska Region Archival Collection room, which Stephanie Stevens used to run, but I think she's in D.C. now. But that and my Katmai work and several other things should be down there.
The admin history is so detailed. Do you go back and look at like all the correspondence from all the previous administrative?
There's a lot of correspondence. Well, it should all be self-explanatory just by looking at the footnotes.
Yeah.
A lot of correspondence had been collected right there in the Anchorage office. I did not spend a lot of time back in the Skagway office going through correspondence files at that time. There may have been, a few planning folders or so that I went through, but most of my work was done. There were some interviews that I conducted with Skagway people.
Mm-hmm.
But then also one thing that the superintendent insisted on was that once I had a draft done of this, I ran it by the mayor and by two or three other mm-hmm. people some of whom were not necessarily friendly to the park's aims. And I said, regardless of how you feel about me or the Park Service, do you want to look at this and make any? And most of them didn't. But at least by offering that gesture, it provided us an opportunity to say we did our best to try to, share this and to get commentary from other people.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've written a number of admin histories for Alaska Parks. Is that a type of work that you enjoy?
Yeah. I now work for the Trails office here in Santa Fe, and I've written an administrative history of the Trails program. So I guess it's just something that, I've developed a certain facility with.
And when you were in the Anchorage office, how were you assigned your particular duties?
Usually these things just kind of evolved at certain times. People, and of course this is something that Sandy would know better than I would. Are you planning on talking to her by any chance?
I don't know yet.
Okay, because I can give you contact information if you need it. But, she was my boss for 12 years.
Okay.
And a fellow named Ted Birkedahl, who was the head of cultural resources, I saw him just a few months ago, so I could get you in touch with him as well.
I've been in touch with him, yeah.
Okay. And I think what takes place is that after I had been there a while and people could see that, I could put a sentence together and that I wasn't, I seemed to be doing okay. But I think people would come to Sandy or Ted and try to grab my time. And they would be the people who would sort of ration those out and decide, who would be doing what.
Yeah.
So, go ahead.
I was going to say, they have big comprehensive reports, not only the admin history, that history of subsistence. Didn't you do that one also?
Yeah,
big topics.
Well, and in this case, Paul Anderson, who was the deputy regional director, and he was in charge of superintendent's activities, said, subsistence management is so complicated. And I didn't know squat about subsistence management until he approached me about this. But he said, we really need to have some idea about saying not only what is subsistence management now, but how did it get to be that way? And it's a very complicated situation in which what that meant, it was just very satisfying to kind of rip it out by the roots and say, how did subsistence get from kind of its historical lifestyle, and how did the whole thing get codified and bureaucratized? And, to me, ipso facto, it's absolutely necessary that subsistence resources need to be managed and regulated, because if not, there are a whole lot of urban hunters out there that would just decimate populations. And hunters themselves recognize the necessity for rationalization and ways of protecting these herds, and they recognize that caribou herds swell and shrink and move and split off, and what does government do in its best possible way without becoming oppressive? And there's no easy answer for it. It takes a 200-page book to to nail it down.
Yeah. So, and then as soon as you're done with that 200-page book, something's changed.
Yeah.
In the policy or the management or the politics.
Well, fortunately, I was able to kind of walk it through the whole process until, because for a number of years, hunting was regulated, but fisheries wasn't. And then Katie John came along, and there was a whole lot of, you know, legislative activity that tried to approach and deal with that. But after a while, you know, the state legislature just either couldn't or wouldn't. Mm-hmm. And so for better or worse, you know, we began, you know, managing subsistence fisheries resources after a while. And, you know, it was a brand new ballgame. And so structurally, I think that the major steps, at least up to 2003, were done. What's happened since then? I mean,
it's constantly changing.
That's for somebody else to write another administrative history.
you mentioned the Seattle unit of Klondike, and I want to get back to that, because in the 88 interview, you know, you were asked about other projects and that you thought should be done, and the Seattle's role in the Gold Rush is mm-hmm. one thing you mentioned. And so I was wondering if you have any experience to see whether you think that has been better represented and studied now.
Well, I mean, I guess I ended up answering my own question by including a couple of chapters in there. I had a chance to go down and talk to Willie Russell, who was the superintendent mm-hmm. and a longtime superintendent at that time. And I'm glad I did, because he had been superintendent for, I'd say, 8 or 9 years, and for medical reasons needed to retire not long after I had a chance to chat with him. But the Seattle unit was established and is entirely there as an interpretive unit based strongly on education with local school districts and with people coming to visit Pioneer Square. And so its focus is entirely different. And because of its position in the Pioneer Square area, it attracts different kinds of employees, and their length of tenure is far different than it would be if they were in a park where a lot of, you know, nationally significant resources are close by and being interpreted. Mm-hmm. So it was a wake-up call to talk to, because I asked to have a chance to interview a number of you know, people who were working as interpreters.
So you think that, well, are you saying that their staff tends to be more short-term people than on other parks?
Historically, it's shown to be that way.
Okay.
Because the primary purpose is interpretation and educational, oftentimes with school groups, and the number of, I think, between the kind of pay that's offered, and it's usually not very high, and Seattle economic opportunities and costs, I think people just don't last there for a very long
yeah.
time. Or they use that as a way to hop into a more permanent position or in something, you know, in some other park.
So when you were working for the park in Skagway, what was the relationship like with the Seattle unit? Was there any
None.
Mixing? None.
Yeah. When the park had originally been created, and I go into a
right.
couple of sentences in the admin history, there was some hope that, like, for instance, Dick Hoffman wanted to consider that he was the superintendent of both parks.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't get very far with that notion, primarily because you're talking about two regional outfits that are, you know, the legislation calls for both units, but the way that the Park Service administers its units with different funding pots and different access to various funding opportunities, it just didn't work out very
because
well.
Because the Seattle unit's part of the Pacific Northwest region, right?
It had been part of the Pacific Northwest region. It's now part of the Pacific West region.
Oh.
because in 94, there was a reorganization of the Park Service, and both the Southwest region, where I am, and the Pacific Northwest region both disappeared.
Oh, okay.
They were subsumed within other regions.
All right, okay, but the Seattle unit is not part of the Alaska region, so you'd have Klondike unit and the Seattle unit together, mm-hmm. but under different regions, and that was problematic.
And it's always been that way.
Yeah, but there wasn't any cooperation with interpretation and education material.
So far as I know,
at the time you were there,
I think I talked to the superintendent, you know, Clay Alderson, and I think he said once every year or two he gets together with the superintendent, but it's almost like, you know, a lunch meeting. It's
right.
it's nothing mandated. There's no assumed uniformity of purpose. I think it's just more or less keeping in touch and trading ideas back and forth.
And any sense whether that's changed?
I have no idea whether it's changed.
I also wanted to ask you about the Moore House.
Okay.
Before I do the Moore House, on the Seattle unit, do you feel like the Seattle role, the story of the Seattle role, is that now being represented at the Klondike Park, or did you do any work with that?
Well, the Seattle unit, just the nature of what the unit is, it really focuses in on what happened in Seattle
right.
and Puget Sound during 97 and 98. Lisa Maghetto wrote a very good historic resource study. It was a contract job. She worked for Historical Resource Associates. And about the role of Seattle during the Gold Rush, one thing I'd been curious about, and a number of others also, is what was the role of the Klondike Gold Rush in determining which city had supremacy, commercial supremacy in Puget Sound. And there are those that claim that the Klondike Gold Rush was a major factor in Seattle becoming prominent over Tacoma or Everett or anybody else. That's a little over the top to say that. You could say that it was one of a number of factors that resulted in Seattle's supremacy, but it was certainly not the major one.
And in Skagway's interpretation exhibits, publications, do they ever talk about the Seattle side, or they just focus on the Skagway?
Well, they do, but they talk about San Francisco and Victoria and you know, the whole nature of how people got to Skagway and kind of larger aspects of the Gold Rush experience.
Okay.
They tend to concentrate on the arrival end of things rather than the process of how they got through on the way there.
Right, and they don't talk about people who maybe did well in the Gold Rush and went back to some other place in the lower 48 and used that money.
That's pretty tangential to what Skagway talks about, because
right.
most of what Skagway talks about is getting off the boats, getting through town, the difficulties like with public safety and such of getting through, arriving in Skagway, taking a flatboat over to Dyea, arranging for somehow getting up the trail, what the different towns were like during the Gold Rush, what the routes were along both corridors
right.
getting up there, and how those routes changed, what kind of resources were along those routes, both in terms of, you know, how well populated. I mean, there were scads of stores in Canyon City and Sheep Camp, as well as in Dyea.
Right.
Just what a non-wilderness experience it was, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
You know, about how the White Pass is much more of a commercial route, whereas the Chilkoot was, you know, as ugly as going over Chilkoot Pass is, it's a shorter trail, and most people took that trail, whereas it was the commercial packers, you know, Bartlett Brothers, I guess it was, and then of course the railroad
right.
Focused things on the White Pass side.
So but the Moore House, did you have anything to do with that property and the?
Are you talking Moore Cabin or Moore House?
Well, I guess I should. Yes, both.
Okay.
The Moore Cabin, I guess, was the first one.
Yeah, the Moore Cabin was built in 87, and it is where the Moores lived until the Moore House was completed in about 1896. It was completed before the main gold rush took place, I think. Although the Moore House, there's been a historic structures report written about the Moore House, and it shows different configurations and sizes of that. Just like any house, you know, they've added a bunch of new rooms
right.
over time. But
you didn't do that historic structures.
No.
No. Okay.
And really, when I think about the Moore House and Moore Cabin, I've been more of a broad brush historian and not specific structurally related. So I would always stop at Moore Cabin and Moore House along as one stop on the walking tours that I would give.
Mm-hmm.
And like I was fascinated by all the newspapers on the inside and such. I was not part of the decision-making process by which the Moore Cabin was essentially dismantled and put together again, because the Moore Cabin was made out of an awful lot of cottonwood logs went into it.
Mm.
And so by the time I showed up in 83, the cottonwood logs had essentially caved in
yeah.
and were not very structurally sound. Of course, there was a lot of Sitka spruce in the area that held up better, but the Park Service made kind of the command decision that the most valuable resources in that cabin were the newspapers on the inside and Moore's personal role, which is not a definable or, you know, it doesn't have objects that go along with it. So they essentially rebuilt that cabin.
Hmm.
There are some cross pieces under the eaves that are original, but I think virtually everything else is not only new, but they also jacked the whole thing up so that it's like, I don't know, I'd say 2 feet off the ground now, which I guess is good in terms of you know, ensuring that freeze and thaw and everything
right.
is not going to impact the building. But none of those decisions I had anything to do with.
Okay. And there was the controversy about the property line and the street and realigning mm-hmm. all that. Was that during your tenure?
No, that was way before my tenure. But it's something that caused some ire with the local townspeople, because the Park Service insisted that because the Moore lot was not part of the town grid, and of course all the old plat maps reflect that, they really wanted a chunk of the Moore lawn to be taken out excuse me, so that tour buses could go from, what would that be, Fifth Avenue, I guess,
yeah.
swinging over to Spring Street.
Around the lumber yard there.
Yeah, yeah. And the ice house and that kind of thing. And the Park Service would not give on that. But I played no role in, I mean, that was an established policy and no one has changed.
Because I thought
that.
It was during Clay Alderson's time as superintendent that there was a big battle over that. And maybe that was about the fence.
Well, there probably was, but it wasn't the first one.
Maybe that was about the fence. I don't,
yeah.
But you didn't have anything to do with that.
Oh, no. I mean, remember all the way through the 80s, I was a seasonal. And then you know, I wrote this thing
right.
from 500 miles away.
Right.
So I've never been a policy person.
Yeah, well, I didn't
I'm
know
saying.
If yeah any of the if you had done any research or your work had been used in any of those discussions, and that you would have gotten involved somehow. But it sounds like
actually Bob put together a major set of material that was put into a microfilm roll that talked about the Moore, it was called the Moore Townsite File. In other words, when Moore owned about two-thirds of what today's Lower Skagway
right.
is, you know, about 16, 18 blocks, something like that. And when Frank Reed and the other kind of ad hoc town founders came in there during the winter of 97-98, they kind of played God and told the Moores, You know, there's 10,000 of us and there's two of you. You know, why do you deserve to keep much of any of it? And I think both of the Moores were just as nasty as Frank Reed was. and so they were able to keep that chunk of land that they did, probably with a lot of acrimony involved, but Moore also had a house over at about 5th and State or 5th and Main. And I think Burton writes about how he was out there in the middle of the street trying to forcibly prevent the townspeople from moving that building away and taking it from him, because I think when they laid out the grid of the town, his building was in the middle of the street. You know, so they essentially said, "This is not yours. We're either going to tear it down or move it someplace." And you know, Moore couldn't do a thing about it.
Because they were now the city leaders, I guess. And
yeah.
Yeah, that'd be... You've talked all these different things you've done, and to me it sounds like you got paid to do research and write, which sounds pretty good to me.
That's what historians do for a living.
Is that what it was?
Well, I mean, that's what historians do for a living. We research and write. We spend way too much time on other bureaucratic tasks, but fortunately in my case, I was able to spend a good deal of my time in Anchorage actually research and writing.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And not, you know, supervising programs or supervising other employees. So yes, I'm proud to say that I was able to immerse myself in a number of projects, of some of which we've talked about here. Mm-hmm. I was able to write, you know, things that I thought had a huge amount of interest to me personally, and maybe somebody's gotten some benefit out of it. Oh. I mean, you never know. I mean, you put something out there and it takes on a life of its own. You know, maybe somebody will look at it and maybe it won't, but that's not your problem. Yeah.
Have you gotten any feedback from people about your various publications?
Oh, I'm not sure how to answer that. Every now and then people come back and say, you know, they want to know more information about a topic that I've written about in the book and in a book. I think more often I probably get feedback from articles that I've written for the in Alaska History Journal, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that we haven't talked about is about 2000, I think it was, I essentially examined the role of Skagway as a company town.
Oh.
Yeah, this is 2000, 2001, somewhere in there. And because I'd had conversations with a number of people in Skagway that talked about the let's face it, the predominance of White Pass in
right.
in determining city affairs, and I knew it was never a classic company town, but when one company hires everybody, you know, all the major jobs in town.
Yeah, I sort of thought of it as a company town in a way, and I've wondered about that. So
uh-huh.
because it does feel like it. During a certain period with the White Pass, it was a company town. How was it not a company town?
Well, but company towns can be defined in different ways. Sometimes in an oppressive, you know, I owe my soul to the company store kind of way. But in other ways, and in fact, this is true in White Pass's case, they saw to it that they kept, like when the Depression hit, they were down to two trains a week going between Skagway and Whitehorse. And they saw to it that a whole bunch of people kept working in town that by any kind of economic efficiency probably should have been, let go.
Mm-hmm.
And probably some people were let go. Because something like that happened in the 1930s, I don't really know that all that well. But this gave me a chance, for instance, to talk about Skagway's role in building the Klondike Highway,
mm-hmm.
because there were a whole bunch of attempts. You know, people knew back in 1902 that they wanted a highway connecting them with Whitehorse, but between cost and the logistics of it, you know, it just never happened. But there were times in which 20 guys would be out at the end of the road with shovels and other really, you know, like garden equipment, and trying to add another 5 or 10 feet onto the highway, just as kind of a demonstration to show how much they wanted to see a route out of town. And of course, this all that activity really needed to wait until the 70s, when the state of Alaska had the money to be able to work with it, and apparently the government of either Canada or Yukon Territory also had some funds. You know, they could see that if we were, we had an interest, then they were able to reciprocate that interest.
But the other thing is the role of Skagway in the construction of the Alaska Highway, mm-hmm. as well, right?
That's right. And probably more should be written about Skagway's role as an Alaska Highway town, because we have maps in the upstairs in the park office that shows probably 80 or 100 Quonset huts, you know, just constructed around town. Sometimes Quonset huts, sometimes log buildings. And of course, a lot of these things were later moved onto people's property, so you see examples of what they look like.
Mm-hmm.
Starting in about March of 42 was when they started bringing people in to start working on the highway. And, you know, really Whitehorse played a much larger role, but Skagway was kind of the funnel through the way it all went. And of course, the White Pass, which was in a pretty derelict condition all through the 30s because nobody had any money, all of a sudden there were, you know, in 1943, there were, I don't know, 8 trains a day in each direction, you know, that were going, hauling construction equipment up there to, you know, get the highway built.
Right. So what else, this article you wrote about the role of Skagway as a company town, what were some of your conclusions?
It was to a large extent, but the role of White Pass officials was, in most cases, was pretty benevolent. You know, I think I'll leave it at that.
Okay. So, you know, we're just talking about the good part of the job, being able to have, you know, a historian who gets paid to research and write and not have to teach and not have to do all that other stuff. Were there particular challenges or obstacles that you faced that were...
When I was working in Skagway or working in Anchorage?
Both.
Okay. The nice thing about Skagway is that all the time I worked there, I had a nice work area and was able to do what I wanted to do, but being a seasonal means, on the one hand, you don't get paid very much and you don't get paid all year round, but nobody tells you what to do because you're not important. I mean, you're marginal. I mean, everybody else is part of kind of a hierarchy. My boss, to a large extent, was Bob Spoody in Anchorage, and every week or so, I guess I'd report into him, and you know, he knew I was doing good work, so we just kind of talked like buddies, you know, mm-hmm. when we wanted to bring things up. I'd send things into him. He had this enormous knowledge about the sources and bibliographic side, and so he'd both make sure that I had those sources, and also if I turned in a draft and I missed a few sources, you know, he'd mention them to me. But no, it was a very easygoing relationship.
How often did he come to Skagway?
Oh,
I can ask him that question. But
yeah, really not much. I almost got the feeling that he had official reasons other than seeing me. But that when we talked, we'd head down to the Sweet Tooth or something,
right.
and talk. And it gave him a chance, because he had a passion for Klondike.
Right.
He really liked the gold rush. And so it would give him a chance to come back into town, see old friends, walk the streets, dig into the library, pull things out that he'd thought about, you know, maybe he had some other project he was working on.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it was all very comfortable. Once I got to Anchorage, and maybe I'm looking at this through relatively rose-colored glasses, because I was a historian without, I didn't have any employees under me, and I didn't have large structural parts of my job that demanded I do something different than what I was doing. I spent most of my time, you know, researching and writing. I had three local libraries near, and every now and then I'd go out and, you know, travel for some other purpose. But I think people, and this is just supposition, the Alaska Regional Office had had its share of characters. And when I say characters, on the one hand, you can say, you know, people look at life a little differently. But also, you know, they, you always know that people are kind of keeping an eye on you, saying, you know, is he doing his job? Is he a gold brick? Is he working on another job, you know, on work time? Just gross stuff, you know, like that. I mean, people typically give you the benefit of the doubt, but you know, they watch you for a while, and then after a while they recognize you're okay, and they just give you a nice long rope, because it wouldn't do any good. Well, I mean, there are people that, bosses that give you a very short rope, even right. though you don't need one. But so I had bosses that were wise enough to just give me, you know, a lot of slack. Sandy became my boss starting in about October of 91. A lady named Kate Lidfors hired me, and I had a few bumps with her in the first few months, but she moved on, and so I had, Sandy was a boss from 91 until probably 2004, and then Ted was my boss from then until I left the office in December of 07.
Okay, and why did you choose to leave Anchorage?
I was in a position where I could see that if I didn't leave, that I was going to retire there. And both my wife and I were in a position to say, we'd like, as much as we've enjoyed Anchorage, we are not dyed-in-the-wool Alaskans. It's okay, but we are both feeling a little adventurous. I think, of course, being in Fairbanks, who am I to talk to you about this, but this wasn't anything dramatic, but the darkness of the winter kind of, you know, bugged us a little bit. You know, we had those sad lights that helped us kind of get started in the morning, and we used full spectrum and that kind of thing. I don't need to go into a lot of detail with you about that, but we were just in the position for a change, and there are not really a lot of alternatives that a person in a specialized position like this has coming. So I think this was my second attempt to go someplace else, and the boss said yes, and I came on down. Left in early December and showed up here in early January.
So this was sort of like a lateral transfer within the Park Service?
Yeah, I was a GS-12, and I just stayed that way, and still am.
Are there things in Skagway and the Klondike Park that you think still could be researched, stories that haven't been told yet?
Well, we've talked about the White Pass Unit.
Right.
And I personally would really like to see more archaeological work and more ability to open up that unit. I think it's a little difficult for us, for that park to have a major unit, which is essentially, it's not closed to the public, but it's also not a very easy unit to open up, because both topographically, you know, it doesn't go down into town kind of like the Chilkoot unit does. It's kind of remote and isolated. I would like to see some kind of recreational trail built through that area. And of course you'd need to work with the state or with somebody else on the logistics of that trail. I mean, you're not asking me as a historian, but there's a lot of really interesting history. I understand the need for the park to not open it up immediately because there is such a wealth of resources out there. But, you know, that's been a park now for 40 years, and I would think that I would like to see that park eventually open by having a trail go through there.
Okay. And any other little historical topics? You said one thing is, you know, there's all these parts that hadn't been studied yet. When you were talking at the beginning.
About yeah, and I guess I followed that up by actually doing some of those.
Right.
Like, for instance, I was able to find, when I was down at the archives down in Juneau, I got to know the state archivist pretty well, a fellow named John Stewart, and he apparently did some digging on his own and was able to get out some commissioner's records that listed all of the various civil and criminal cases that had developed during the gold rush period. Hmm. And so I was able to find out, you know, you'd heard all this, a lot of kind of easy talk about the number of prostitutes in both Skagway and Dyea. Well, sure enough, I was able to find an area where, you know, one day when the commissioners weren't doing everything else, they visited every prostitute in town and fined them $10, you know, for, I don't know.
Just because they could.
Yeah, because they could. I think the term was they were loitering, you know, so. But I think that happened to prostitutes all over the West.
Right.
And you know, they were just hassled and then forgotten about it. I mean, they could have prosecuted them and thrown them out of town, but you don't make $10 that way.
But so even though the Gold Rush story seems so well documented, you think there's still things that a historian could pull out?
Believe me, if somebody really wanted to take it on, they could write a Gold Rush history, a more even-handed one. One, because, you know, when Pierre wrote his book in 1957, there just wasn't a whole lot known, and he knew it in his bibliography.
Right.
I'd like to think that, you know, based on the work that the Park Service has done and a whole lot of other people as well, that there could be a more even-handed, more balanced between Canada and the U.S., something that would go in and talk a little bit more about the broader migration routes, you know, where people came from.
I know you did some work on immigrants in Alaska as well, right?
Yeah. That was north to Alaska.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, the people who came for the Klondike, where they came from.
How many of them were international? You know, how many were Canadians? How many were U.S. and are records available that can help tamp that kind of thing down?
And it seems like the Klondike Park is also expanding a little bit to more recent history of Skagway. It's not just Gold Rush. It's other parts of the stories of the town. And,
okay.
You know, and as you said, the role of the military and things. I think they are expanding a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's officially in their documents, but.
Well, like for instance, Lynch and Kennedy is a building that was that housed troops for a while, but I don't think there's any interpretation done that demarcates that.
Right.
You know, that was that whole pack train complex there.
Right. So my last question is, you've had a long career with the Park Service. Why have you stayed working for the Park Service?
Because I love working for the National Park Service.
Well,
why? I get up in the morning and this is what I want to do.
What is it about the Park Service?
I find that the people that work for this agency, by and large, not all of them, are very dedicated people who all have high standards of work. And so there's no, you know, and yes, there are some, but very few people are content to just get by. I find it very gratifying because I feel better when I'm doing hard work to do a job really well. And it's very comforting to know that the people that I work with feel likewise. That is not true in a lot of jobs. And so I have a good boss, I have good coworkers. People put a lot of trust in me. I enjoy working with a lot of non-NPS partners. in this job, we work with a lot of trail associations, with Trailateers Association, Santa Fe Trail Association. And I enjoy working with them on a business arrangement, and I enjoy having beers with them every now and then. What's there not to like?
Yeah.
I'm going to retire in a few months, but, because I love history and because of the kind of work I've done, it's been a very satisfying career.
Some people would say what's not to like is the bureaucracy of an organization like the Park Service.
I find that the bureaucracy of the Park Service is either necessary and I can kind of understand it, or it doesn't get to me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on in Washington, D.C. that I think, well, that's not my call.
Yeah.
So, doesn't bother me.
Okay. And in terms of your work in Skagway in Alaska, are there particular things you think you've made a contribution and would like to be remembered for?
I'll let others decide that.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to add that I haven't asked you about?
Oh.
That you can think of?
Oh, I suppose I can go back and look at my resume and say, hey, have you thought of that article or something else? But,
Yeah, I was trying not to focus on the specific. Somebody can look up your name for all your publications.
Yeah.
If they're really interesting.
You were talking about specific assignments when mm-hmm. I was a seasonal. At one point, I filled out National Register forms. A National Register form for the National Park or National Historic Park, as well as the NHL forms for the, the Daiichi Chilkoot mm-hmm. unit and the Skagway White Pass unit. It was more or less a secretarial exercise because all of the elements of those forms had already been included in one of those previous NHLs. So I think my name is on part of that, but it's not really very consequential, only because there's kind of a bureaucratic requirement for every historically based park to have a National Register nomination for it. Yeah.
And so has that been accepted for Klondike? Is it officially on the National Register?
I mean, it went through sometime in 86, 87, right. Something like that.
I would have assumed. Now, so it's not, each building is not nominated, it's the district, the whole park.
The building, elements of that were all of the Park Service owned buildings in Skagway. I don't know, it was one of those things because it didn't have new information into it. I didn't really think much about it. And because it wasn't controversial, I never had to spend a lot of extra time, dealing with it. Like, I know the Skagway White Pass nomination fairly well because we'd send it in and, a year and a half later, somebody in Washington, D.C. would come back and say, you've written too much about this area and not enough about this area.
Oh, really?
You got to, the notion of NHL boundaries was kind of a political topic in Washington, D.C. And there were people that said, unless you can prove that there are contributing resources, then you have to eliminate that area. But other people had a more relaxed approach, more of a landscape interpretation rather than trying to justify structures and contributing corporeal areas related to the Gold Rush period.
I just didn't realize that process would have a back and forth. I figured you write your report and request and it gets submitted and it's accepted or not accepted.
No, Sandy can tell you more than I can, but I found myself thinking in like 93, 95, 98, I thought, I'm going to make sure I stay in this job long enough to be able to see this thing through. And eventually somebody in D.C. gave in and signed off on the thing.
Yeah, hard work. Do you have any sense of the relationship between, the Klondike Park and regional office? Was there push-pull? Was there resentment that regional was doing stuff that the park thought it should do? Or?
If anything, I would have personal conversations with superintendents, and And Klondike, as important historically as it is 12,000 acres, okay? Gates of the Arctic has 8 million. Wrangell-St. Elias has 12 million. Lake Clark has 4.5 million. Katmai has, you know, 3.5 or 4. So somebody like Clay would go to a meeting of the superintendents and just feel overwhelmed or intimidated because all these superintendents, you know, would be talking about not only much larger areas, but they'd be talking about about subsistence and about wilderness and about a number of other topic areas mm-hmm. that just didn't concern, you know,
right.
Sitka or Klondike. So other than that, no further comments.
Okay, and the Clay you mentioned is Clay Alderson, who was superintendent. Yeah. And he became superintendent when you were still based in Skagway?
Yeah, he was acting superintendent in 86, and I think he became the superintendent, you know, just a few months after that, and then stayed there for probably 6, 8, 10 years, something like that.
So 99.
Was it that long? Okay.
Yeah.
I think the last I heard of him, he became part of he worked with the Office of International Affairs and represented the Park Service in Mongolia for a while.
Do you have any comment on his superintendency?
No. None that I'd like to share on tape.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to share on tape before we...
I think we've pretty well covered things.
Okay. Great. Well, I appreciate your time.
I'm glad to help. Yeah, mm-hmm. Gosh, we talked...